Random House Audiobooks presents The Greatest Generation by Tom Brokaw. Read for you by the author.
The Greatest Generation. In the spring of 1984, I went to the northwest of France, to Normandy, to prepare an NBC documentary on the 40th anniversary of D-Day, the massive and daring Allied invasion of Europe that marked the beginning of the end of Adolf Hitler's Third Reich. I was well prepared with research on the planning for the invasion, the numbers of men, ships, airplanes, and weapons involved, the tactical and strategic errors of the Germans, and the names of the Normandy villages that in the midst of battle provided critical support to the invaders. What I was not prepared for was the emotional impact this experience would have on me. When I began working on the 40th anniversary, I was excited by the history. My earliest memories were of that war. Between the ages of 3 and 5, I lived on an army base in western South Dakota, and I spent a good deal of my time outdoors in a tiny helmet shooting stick guns at imaginary German and Japanese soldiers. The first time I ever saw my mother cry was when the army base commander decided my father, Red Brokaw, a Mr. Fix-It and an all-purpose operator of snowplows and construction machinery, was too valuable to the base operations and had him brought back home when he was drafted. These were powerful images for an impressionable boy. The war effort was all around us. Ammunition was tested on the South Dakota sagebrush prairie before being shipped out to the battlefront positions. Neighbors always seemed to be going off to or coming home from the war. There was even a stockade of Italian prisoners of war living on the edge of the base. My grandfather followed the war's progress on his maps. My wife Meredith, raised in Yankton, South Dakota, to which the Brokaws moved later, was born shortly before her father, a doctor, was shipped out to Europe. She saw him only once when he returned from the war when she was 3, and then not again until she was 5. And so, as it turned out, I had stored up a reservoir of memories of that dramatic time in America. Yet, when I arrived in Normandy 40 years later, those memories had receded, replaced by days of innocence in the 50s, by my covering the turmoil of Vietnam and the social upheavals of the 60s, Watergate in the 70s, and by my traveling the world for NBC News. I was thinking much more about the prospects of the Cold War than the lessons of the war of my early years, and I was simply looking forward to what I thought would be an interesting assignment in a part of France celebrated for its hospitality, seafood, and Calvados, the local brandy made of apples. Instead, I underwent a life-changing experience. As I walked the Normandy beaches with the American veterans who had landed there and returned for the 40th anniversary, men at the time in their 60s and 70s, and listened to their stories of the war and the lessons they took from it into the useful lives they built afterward, I was deeply moved and profoundly grateful that I was witness to their acts of heroism and bravery in time of war and to what they gave to America and the world in the years after it. These men and women, born between 1910 and on into the 1920s, came of age in the Great Depression, when economic despair was on the land like a plague. They had watched their parents lose their businesses, their farms, their jobs, their hope. They had learned to accept a future that played out one day at a time. Then, just as there was a glimmer of economic recovery, war exploded across Europe and Asia. When Pearl Harbor made it irrefutably clear that America was not a fortress, this generation was summoned to the parade ground and told to train for war. They left their ranches in Sully County, South Dakota, their jobs on the main street of America's Georgia. They gave up their places on the assembly lines in Detroit and the ranks of Wall Street. They quit school or went from cap and gown directly into uniform. They answered the call to help save the world from the two most powerful and ruthless military machines ever assembled, instruments of conquest in the hands of fascist maniacs. They faced great odds and a late start, but they did not protest. At a time in their lives when their days and nights should have been filled with innocent adventure, love, and the lessons of the workaday world, they were fighting, often hand-to-hand in the most primitive possible conditions, across the bloody landscape of France, Belgium, Italy, Austria. They fought their way up a necklace of South Pacific islands few had ever heard of before, and made those islands a fixed part of American history. The islands had names such as Iwo Jima, Guadalcanal, Okinawa. They were in the air every day, in skies filled with terror, and they went to sea on hostile waters far removed from the shores of their homeland. New branches of the service were formed to get women into uniform, working at tasks that would free more men for combat. Other women served out of uniform, going to work in the laboratories and in the factories, developing new machines, building ships, planes, and tanks, raising their families all alone. America's preeminent physicists were engaged in a secret race to build a new bomb before Germany figured out how to harness the atom as a weapon. Without their efforts and sacrifices, our world would be a far different place today. These veterans came home to joyous and short-lived celebrations and immediately began the task of rebuilding their lives and the world they wanted. They were mature beyond their years, tempered by what they had been through, disciplined by their military training and sacrifices, and knowledgeable, too. They had gotten to know and respect people they never would have met before. They had been places they never would have been otherwise. And they had learned the true value of a life. They married in record numbers and gave birth to another distinctive generation, the baby boomers. They stayed true to old American values of duty and honor and service, faith, taking personal responsibility for one's actions. A grateful nation made it possible for more of them to attend college than in any society ever before, anywhere. The GI Bill for that education was the gift of a grateful nation for service and sacrifice, and it filled to capacity the colleges and universities across the country. Campus classrooms and housing were overflowing with young men, many of whom had never expected to get a college education. They left those campuses with degrees and a determination to make up for lost time. They were a new kind of Army now, moving onto the landscape of industry, science, art, public policy, all fields of American life, bringing to every endeavor the same passion and discipline that had served them so well during the war. They helped convert wartime industry facilities into what became the most powerful economy in history. They made breakthroughs in science and gave the world new art. They came to understand the need for federal civil rights legislation. They helped give America Medicare. They rebuilt the infrastructure of their former enemies, and they stood fast against totalitarianism in a new form, communism. They were rocked by the social and political upheavals of the 60s. Many of them hated the long hair, the free love, and especially what they saw as desecration of the flag. But in the end, they didn't give up on this new generation. They weren't perfect. They made mistakes. They allowed McCarthyism and racism to go unchallenged for too long. Women of the World War II generation, who had demonstrated convincingly that they had so much more to offer than what could be seen only in the milieu of their households, became the underpinning for the liberation of their gender, even as many of their husbands resisted that idea. When a new war broke out, many of the veterans initially failed to recognize the many differences between their war and the one being waged in Vietnam. Yet, as I began to listen to their stories, the themes of greatness and the living of ordinary lives began to appear. Their stories did not come forth easily. They didn't volunteer them. I learned to stay back a step or two, listening as they walked the beaches themselves, quietly exchanging memories. When I returned to Normandy again for the 50th anniversary of D-Day, my wife Meredith joined me. By 1994, I felt a kind of missionary zeal for the men and women of the World War II generation, and I'd begun spreading the word of their remarkable lives. I was inspired by them, by their example, and by their values. The work of my friend Stephen Ambrose also inspired me, the energetic, plain-talking historian who had written the account of the invasion called simply D-Day, June 6, 1944. From him, I had learned that the men and women told the stories best themselves. So I said to Meredith, "Whenever one of these guys comes over to say hello, just ask, where were you that day?" And so we did, wherever we went. It was during our coverage of the 50th anniversary of D-Day in 1994 that I was asked by Tim Russert on Meet the Press my thoughts on what we were witnessing on that occasion. As I looked over the crowd of veterans, which included cabinet officers and captains of industry, and retired schoolteachers and machinists, I said, "I think this is the greatest generation any society ever produced." I know it was a bold statement and a sweeping judgment, but I went on to make my case, and I believe I have the facts on my side.